Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Zatarain's, maker of New Orleans pantry staples like Creole mustard, fish fry, and jambalaya mix since 1889. Recipes and more at Zatarain's.com. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. In case you hadn't heard, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival is currently celebrating 50 years of festing right here in the Crescent City. To mark this momentous occasion, we're celebrating the Louisiana food heritage that the festival has honored and celebrated since its earliest days. It still surprises me when I meet people who don't know about the food heritage stage at the fest. Located just inside the grandstand, some of New Orleans' most celebrated chefs not only give away their secrets there, but free tastes of Louisiana's best as well. The Food Heritage Stage is celebrating just 30 years of festing this year. For two decades, the programming there has been done by Michelle Nugent, Festival Food Director. Michelle joins us and explains exactly how she makes all that magic happen while supervising the entire food and beverage operation out there. Then, we'll turn back time with the help of the Jazz and Heritage Foundation's archives. For a decade prior to 2005, the demos were videotaped, giving us the opportunity to hear again from greats like Austin Leslie and Jamie Shannon. 30 years ago, local attorney Steve Armbruster anchored the inaugural Food Heritage Stage. Steve's here for a walk down that delicious memory lane. I hope you came hungry, because we've got a festival full of delicious delights on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Hi, my name's Michelle Nugent, and I'm the food director at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival.
As Jazz Fest's food director, Michelle Nugent is in charge of an operation that works year-round to be able to transform the fairgrounds infield into one of the city's most massive outdoor food destinations. With scores of vendors serving hundreds of thousands of festival goers over two weekends, Michelle has to ensure that everything from permits to staff meals to infrastructure are squared away well in advance. Which is why on pre-production days, you'll find her on her trusty golf cart working from pre-dawn to dusk.
So let's start with the golf cart since you mentioned that. I have a custom toolbox that I put on the back of it that I can lock up, and you can find anything on there from blue paint tape to sharp scissors to a cold bottle of water. Because I never know where I'm going to be. It's such a huge festival site that I don't want to have to think about it. I just want to be able to reach in my tackle box and pull it out. I outfit myself in the same way. I have a gear belt that I wear all day, every day that has scissors and all kinds of stuff on it. On a pre-production day, we're pretty much just getting the vendors loaded in and just getting everything built, making sure the stage is all ready to go. Some of my favorite times are at the end of a pre-production day when things are starting to get quiet. And I get in my golf cart, you know, get a fresh cold bottle of water and a notepad and just kind of take your time and wander through and check it all out and see what happened and what needs to go on the next day. And the baby geese are there and the hawks are flying around your head and the sun is setting. It's beautiful. It's a nice place to work.
Michelle filled us in on how she came to be involved with the Jazz Fest, its challenges, and moments that have stuck with her since she first had her hand in the operation.
On paper, this is my 20th festival. I actually have done 21, but the first one was a very long time ago. I did a piece of the job in 1986 before I ran away and joined the Susan Spicer Circus and learned how to cook and spent almost 20 years in kitchens. So when I was finally offered the job in 1999, it was kind of perfect. I've always done production work. I've always loved to do production work. I worked in most of the music clubs in town and with a bunch of the bands and did some television and all kinds of stuff. And then I cooked for a long time. So it was perfect. And when I got there, things were set up a little differently. And so I've just kind of grown into it and turned it into the way I think it should be, whether that's right or wrong.
Michelle, it amazes me that I know people who come to the festival regularly and have never been to or heard of the Food Heritage Stage. Would you tell us a little bit about where it is and how it came to be?
Someone that was actually acting as the staff caterer at the time decided that it would be really cool if people could come and see and hear about how we make our food. Because there's always questions about, is it Cajun? Is it Creole? Where does it come from? And so we have two stages. One is inside the grandstand, and one is outside the grandstand. So the one outside the grandstand we call the Cajun Cabin, and it's a little more rustic. We have more pot cooking and things like that. We have a barbecue grill. People make cracklings out there. We used to have a large contingent of firefighters that would come and make their specialties. And inside is a tiny bit more refined. It's all sort of rough, but that's where a lot of the city's premier chefs come and do their demonstrations.
It's a must-do. Everyone must come to the Food Heritage Stage. That they have to tear themselves away from the food booths. And Michelle, out on the festival grounds, somehow, people turn out plates of food that look like they're being served in a white tablecloth restaurant. There's no peanuts and cotton candy at Jazz Festival. Let's talk about the foods, the variety, and the complexity.
Well, there are peanuts, don't forget. There's even popcorn in the kids' area and at one of the snowball stands. But to take your point, we have a vendor that produces a plate that has a handmade crepe stuffed with crawfish, an oyster patty, which is a New Orleans classic. It's a piece of puff pastry with a beautiful oyster stew in it, and then a crawfish beignet, all on one plate, all handmade, perfectly cooked, hot and fresh every minute. It's amazing. It's just remarkable. I don't know how the vendors accomplish it. It's really kind of fairy dust.
Well, for one thing, you provide them with an incredible space. There's running water.
Yeah, we have a pretty serious infrastructure. Every food area has a field kitchen with hot running water and a real place to wash your dishes. We have 6 52-foot refrigeration trucks that we manage ourselves that the vendors take use of, which we have to actually go to a lot of lengths to set up and put shelving in. And then I go on 24-hour call, and we manage them the whole time. So the festival does a lot of work to provide them a good, safe, clean place to work.
And sometimes it rains. Let's
the word we try to never say.
Well, it's been heroic, some of the things I've seen pulled off in the rain, too. But tell us about some of the challenges that you've experienced, because, my goodness, you've had rainstorms where the water came up in the booths.
Well, and sometimes we have to turn the electricity off for a minute and people stand on boxes. And the weirdest phenomena is when the weather is really inclement, we sell more food.
Really?
I don't know if it's because people don't want to stand in front of the stages or what exactly happens, but the food vendors actually get busy. So very rarely do we have to stop selling, but we kind of have to go into extra special pay attention mode when we have to shut the electricity off just to make sure that we're maintaining all our temperatures and that everything is safe. But we actually get busier. It's really weird. But everybody's just told right off the bat, if you don't have a pair of rain boots, go get some. Don't even show up without them. Put them in your car, and hopefully you won't need them. But we don't stop. We work in the rain. It's what we do.
There's such a diversity of music that appeals to different age groups, and sometimes you'll be There'll be more of a certain crowd at the festival one day than the next. Did the vendors ever find that the different kinds of crowds attract different interest in the foods? Is there ever any correlation?
Absolutely. It really just depends. If we have a Latin crowd that day, then the food that's tilted that way, we sell more of that. If we have a really heavy college crowd, we sell lots of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
No way.
I promise you. It's pretty interesting how that works out.
You know, you have been doing this job now for over 20 years, working with a lot of the same people. Tell me about the relationships you've formed with the vendors and the relationships that the vendors have with each other. It's kind of like a big family out there in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Absolutely, which means that it's all the joy and love and greatness that you have with family, and then it's also the same kind of weirdnesses that you have with family. So when the food booths are full tilt boogie on a Saturday afternoon, it's somewhere around 1,600 people, maybe a little more. So that's a lot of folks. And it's hot, and they're in a hurry, and they're working really hard, and they really don't have time to stop and think. So it gets to the point where it's on autopilot, and one of the things that the festival and the vendors are very good at is we're able to solve problems really quickly. We're really good at that.
Oh, yes, you are.
And like you said, most of the vendors have been there longer than I have, and we pride ourselves on that because what they do is extraordinary. It's unlike any other food festival, and it's very specialized what they do. And a lot of the food you can't find anywhere else in the city except for those, this year, 8 days at the festival.
What is your most magical memory? What's the thing that sticks with you?
I'm going to say this just because I relived this moment today at our press conference. So this one's very fresh. Irma Thomas came and sang for us today at the press conference, and the year after the storm, when we weren't really sure we were going to have a show, I happened to be backstage at the Acura stage, which I'm barely ever back there. And it was time for Irma to perform. And the heavens opened up and it started pouring, and she just impromptu started singing "It's Raining." And oh, there wasn't a dry eye in the house, no pun intended.
Oh, it gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, me too.
It's raining so hard, look like it's gonna rain all night, and this is the time I love to be holding you tight.
Michelle Nugent, food director of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival.
The fact that you're not here, I wish the night would hurry up and end, my dear. It's raining so hard, it's really coming down. Sitting by my window, watching the rain fall to the ground.
When we come back from a short break, we go back to the early days of the Food Heritage Stage with the help of the Jazz Fest archives. Louisiana Eats returns in a moment.
It's raining so hard, brings back memories of the time when you were here with me.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and with support from Ralph's on the Park, overlooking City Park's ancient oaks, serving locally sourced Gulf seafood, meats, and farm-fresh produce, all presented with a global spin by Chef Chip Flanagan. Lunch, dinner, Saturday and Sunday brunch, and private parties at 900 City Park Avenue in Mid-City.
Frank Brightson of Brightson's Restaurant.
Thank you. 1998 Jazz Festival. Now, I'm going to do a dish today for you that I think is representative of the type of food that we do at Brightson's and also the flavors and dishes that I love.
Chef Frank Brightson and I agree. Our favorite cooking demo of the year is always on the Food Heritage stage at the Jazz Fest. Frank's been out there all 30 years. I've participated for a mere 25. For many of those years, I knew there was a videographer recording the demos, and I'd always wondered what had happened to that tape. For the 50th anniversary, Michelle Nugent and Matthew Goldman, the festival's press director, allowed me to research over 20 hours of tape in order to assemble a 15-minute video which will play continuously throughout this year's fest at the Food Heritage stage. Here's a sampling of what I discovered.
I'd like to say, first of all, that I think you people, and I can tell by looking at you, are the smartest, best-looking, luckiest people on the whole planet to be here today. Because you're in the best place. Great food, great music, great people, great weather, and we're going to have nothing but fun.
Here's Frank Brightson back in 1998. Consummate entertainer that he is, every second of Frank's demos were solid gold.
We're going to cook catfish today. Now, you've had catfish, I know. Everybody eats catfish. But you ain't never had it like this. You know, when I create a dish, I try to build certain components or characteristics into it so that you have an interesting dish. You know, food, unlike many other arts or crafts, is something that touches you. I mean, you get touched so many ways. You know, it's so physical, it's so emotional, it's so mental, and it's so pleasurable. And smell is certainly a part of that. Visual, the presentation of a dish is certainly important. And of course, the eating part of it is the best, too.
If y'all are just joining us, this is Chef Susan Spicer, the Biona restaurant in the French Quarter, making crawfish curry.
Very good, very good. Bingo.
Chef Susan Spicer was out there from the earliest days as well. In a video dating back to 1995, she's seen on stage wearing her trademark bandana, working on a mango chutney.
So this is the ginger, which you can't see because I got this big mango up here. I'm just mincing a little bit of ginger.
The audio isn't so good, but it's a thrill to witness Susan just as she was experiencing the first flush of great success at what is now her flagship restaurant, Bayona.
And actually, it's really nice. We're in the process of celebrating our five-year anniversary this month. And the chef that I worked for in 1982 in Paris came over and did a guest chef week with us last week, and it was just a really fantastic experience. Being a Parisian, I think he was very amazed at how friendly the people were here in New Orleans and how welcome he was.
Anybody who's just joined us, this is Lucy Mike King. She's a strawberry farmer from Hammond, Louisiana.
I've been growing strawberries since I was 5 years old, and I'm going to be 79.
It's not just chefs who graced the Food Heritage stage at Jazz Fest. One mainstay was strawberry farmer Mrs. Lucy Mike, who always appeared there both weekends. Miss Lucy Mike was one of a kind.
I used to grow about 10 acres. Now I have a half an acre.
Half an acre.
Because I do all the work myself. I do everything except the tractor work. I dig the ditches and everything. One man came with a big station wagon. He had a 12-foot ladder on his station wagon. Well, he hurried up and unloaded the ladder. I said, "Sir, what are you going to do with that ladder?" He says, "I am going to get on it, and I am going to pick the biggest and the sweetest strawberry on the tree." I told him, sir, we don't pick strawberries like that. He said, well, how do you pick them? I told him, you put your head to the ground and you fan it to the sun.
In 2011, Miss Lucy Mike marked her 30th and final year of demonstrating strawberry recipes at Jazz Fest. She passed away in 2013 at the age of 93.
If y'all are just joining us, this is Chef James Shannon of Commander's Palace, and he's working on a duck and mushroom gumbo.
Having succeeded Emeril Lagasse in the Commander's Palace kitchen, young chef Jamie Shannon hadn't yet won his first James Beard when he cooked on the Food Heritage stage.
All right, listen, first of all, is there any locals here other than that guy over there? I'm going to do gumbo, so it's like, you can't do gumbo for locals because everybody and their grandmother has their own recipe for gumbo. Everyone thinks they make the best gumbo, and I'm going to give you a little demonstration of mine. I grew up in New Jersey, and I grew up in the Jersey Shore, and my great-grandparents had a farm, and so I was around a lot of food then, and then my uncles and my godfather, so we're all lobster fishermen. So I moved to New Orleans. I moved here for 6 months, and that was, 11 years ago.
Jamie would continue to be a regular presenter on the Food Heritage stage for years to come. In 2001, the brilliant chef and larger-than-life character that was Jamie Shannon tragically succumbed to cancer at the age of 40.
Let's have a round of applause one more time for Chef Jamie Shannon, Commander's Palace. You say good luck with those James Beard
Awards. Time marches on. The young get old and the old get cold. Time marches on. Nothing lasts forever.
Time marches on. That muffled voice you hear is none other than Austin Leslie, one of the greatest Creole chefs of all time, renowned for his restaurant, Chez Helene.
Now see how easy that was? That's like a piece of cake.
Austin was a New Orleans icon, never seen without his signature captain's hat and bushy mutton chop sideburns. To paraphrase John T. Edge, if you were looking to portray what New Orleans cooking was, there were two chefs, Paul Prudhomme and Austin Leslie.
I don't have Chuck with me today. I got Tyrone Holmes, Buster Holmes' son, you know.
When he appeared on the Food Heritage stage in 1995, Austin brought along a very special assistant, the son of another local hero, red beans and rice superstar, Buster Holmes.
You know, Tyrone's father was one of the first pioneers of the jazz festival, you know, and I was with him. We used to be out here. Oh, yeah, we did the stuffed peppers, the bread pudding. His daddy did the red beans. Buster did it all.
Unfortunately, most of the sound quality of this video is so poor it's almost inaudible. But we'll end with this one last clip to give you a taste of Austin Leslie's sense of humor.
I tell you what, I'm going to tell y'all a pretty clean joke. Since y'all want to hear some jokes, I know y'all didn't ask for them, though. Now, Worcestershire sauce, what is, you know how they got this name, Worcestershire? Fellow was eating and he didn't know how to name what he wants, so he said, what is this here sauce? And they gave it a name, Worcestershire sauce. Don't that make sense? Huh?
Chef Austin Leslie passed away in 2005 at the age of 71.
I love you.
Thanks to Rachel Lyons and Dolores Hooper of the Archive of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation. If you want to see the video we made, replete with memorable moments from the Food Heritage stage, stop by the grandstand at this year's Jazz Fest. Long before he began his career as an attorney at law, Steve Armbruster was a man who wore many hats in his New Orleans life. He co-founded Tipitina's in 1977 and worked at WWOZ Radio. In the 1980s, he had jobs in fine dining kitchens at Upper Line, the Roosevelt, and lost local restaurant, Christian's. Midway through the decade, he began regularly feeding Jazz Fest staff, doing the build-out at the fairgrounds. All of these incarnations of Steve Armbruster made him uniquely qualified to bring a new stage to the festival, the Food Heritage Stage, where New Orleans cooks could talk about food and demonstrate it. Steve explains the origins of these food stages and how he got started.
The very first Food and Heritage Stage was exactly 20 years after it started. It was for the 20th festival, which was 1989. 3 or 4 or 5 years before that, I forget exactly how many, I signed on to help Tag Richardson and the crew that would put up the tents, build the stages, to just be a general laborer. I thought it would be fun. I thought it would make a little extra money. I liked the festival. They quickly realized, like after about one day, that I knew how to cook. They remembered that I'd been cooking. So at that time, believe it or not, everybody who would work to build the stages would just leave the grounds to go get lunch. They would, you know, hop in their trucks and they'd go off to get poor boys a Popeye's fried chicken and, you know, a couple of Barks root beers later and a heavy lunch, they would come dragging back into the fairgrounds and slowly but surely, you know, try to get back on track. And Tag and others realized, you know, that was a pretty inefficient way to, you know, run a crew. And wouldn't it be more fun and wouldn't it be better if I would just cook for everybody? So I started cooking for the production crew, the yard crew. And I did it sort of on a shoestring by, you know, hook and fly. I would maybe set up a barbecue pit out there, or I would cook some things in my house, which was close by. I lived on Grand Route St. John. And I had an old Volkswagen. I would take the back seat out and lay the back flap down. So I might cook a pot of beans, make a salad, have some bread. I would put it in the back of my Volkswagen. I would drive over there, and everybody would see my Volkswagen coming onto the track, and they'd drop their hammers and they'd run over to wherever I happened to park that day, which was under one of the trees or table, and we'd have lunch.
The Volkswagen dinner bell, huh?
Yeah, there you go. By any means necessary, we fed everybody who was there.
And how many people are we talking about in those days?
14, 15 at the beginning, 20, 25, to 50 or 60 or 70 during the week before. It was the perfect job because I didn't have to do anything during the festival itself, because then everybody could get food from the vendors. And also, I knew everybody by then, so, you know, I was, you know, welcome anyway.
Yeah, you were a big man on campus.
It was terrific. Yeah, they liked me. I've been feeding them. And so anyway, so that's one way that I got to know all of the people who were at the fairgrounds and how they got to know me in relation to food. And I did that for a couple of years, and then they decided that they wanted to do this Food Heritage Stage in 1989 for the 20th anniversary. So
they suggest to you, hey, Steve, can you help us out? Because you seem to be able to do everything else you can think of. So what did you do?
Well, the idea was to get the food vendors who are out there to come to the tent and talk about the food that they were serving out there. The producers of the festival did want to educate people about this food of which they were very justly proud.
Tell us about that first year, because things didn't turn out so well because you schedule somebody, but the line at the booth got too long, huh?
So the first Food and Heritage Stage was under a tent, and it was back towards what would be, you know, the Acura stage now, by that pond. The tent was just to the left of it. And the idea was to have a lot of the food vendors. A lot of them would send word, you know, I really can't leave my booth. I'm really busy.
Mm-hmm.
The folks that I've hired here, they don't want me to leave. They get nervous if I'm out of sight, or I get nervous when I have to leave them. So I stocked up a variety of, you know, different sorts of food things, you know, like red beans and rice and pickled meat to have on hand. So sometimes I would just improvise a demonstration of, you know, how to make shrimp stuffed melaton or, you know, shrimp stuffed peppers.
So in addition to food vendors, because that was the original thought, how did the first chefs sneak into the Food Heritage stage?
I knew chefs because I worked as a chef myself. I knew some chefs, like Susan Spicer, from before either of us ever cooked. The first time I met Susan Spicer, she was working for a printing company on Julia Street between Chartist and St. Charles, and I was working at Tipitina's. It was the year we started Tipitina's, and we would go down there to get posters printed. I pressed her into service, and she was glad to do it, and Frank Brightson. Some of the chefs, though, from, you know, your more so-called prestigious or, you know, establishment restaurants, even at that time thought of the jazz festival as something of a fringe operation or, you know, a countercultural, irrelevant production, or it's something that, you know, just didn't really relate to what they were doing. And they just weren't really interested, or maybe they just didn't want to give their secrets or something
so
like that.
So fascinating to think that they had no idea that one day that little fringe festival would actually account for such a huge percentage of their annual business.
Yeah, and they should have realized it even then, and of course some of them did. So Frank came and Susan came, and I'm not sure who all else came, but I think I did press a few other folks into service.
Well, with your long, long vision of all this, did you ever think it would become what it is? I mean, it's such an institution.
It really is fun for a lot of reasons. One reason is because everybody loves to eat. And everybody in Louisiana, it seems, is very passionate about their food, and they all think that they have the best recipe for gumbo or griots, or they know how to grill better than anybody else, or they think that their food is almost as good as Frank Brightson's, but that maybe if they go and listen to him, they can do a little industrial spying and pick up some tips. So people, you know, they're curious about food. And they like talking about it, and they like listening to it. And I think that people who come from out of town see these names on the tops of the food booths, Cochon de Lait, and they wonder about it, and they taste some of the food, and they want to learn a little bit more, so, you know, they go. I think, you know, of course, some people just go to the stage because it's air conditioned, it's inside, and there's free food.
And there's free food. You can't beat that. That's true.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for having this conversation
with us.
You're
welcome.
That was Steve Armbruster, Food Heritage Stage Instigator.
Welcome to the city where people like to eat. Music, 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 you can't resist the beat. Lots of pretty ladies like you've never seen.
Which Jazz Fest vendor has participated for all 50 years of the fest? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Fun-loving people all about the streets. And you down in Big Easy, oh, telling who you meet.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Are you a bar or restaurant owner? Or do you work in a bar or restaurant? Get involved this year with Dine Out for Life, Crescent Care's largest annual fundraiser. This year, we're making a full week of it, starting on Sunday, June 2nd, with a dim sum drag brunch at Maypop, sponsored by Monkey Shoulder. They're taking brunch reservations at Maypop now, but every restaurant and bar can be involved in this year's Dine Out for Life. All proceeds from Dine Out for Life benefit Crescent Care, a full-service health provider with sliding fees designed specially for the hospitality industry. Learn more at crescentcarehealth.org. This week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Which Jazz Fest vendor has participated for all 50 years of the fest? That would be Vance Vokreson. Vance attended that first festival, held at Congo Square in April of 1970, as a baby, literally in his mother's arms. Vance's dad, Sonny Vokreson, carried pre-made sausage poor boys over to the fest from his Bourbon Street restaurant, Vokreson's Creole Cafe. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival has been a family affair for the Vokresons ever since. Another important vendor who certainly deserves a nod is Angelo Brocato. The Brocato family were at that first festival also, serving their lemon ice and other authentic Sicilian treats. They gave up their food booth last year, but thanks to food director Michelle Nugent, you can still find Brocato's lemon ice in the strawberry lemonade booth on the festival grounds. I'm Poppy Tooker, and at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, it's all real Louisiana eats.
Hey, girls. I know that you heard about the big star reviewers coming to town tonight. Well, I just want to give you the lineup of some of the big stars who'll be on the show there. Because somebody's gonna steal the show. Catch your mama, mama, please let me go.
And now, the story of a New Orleans chef who has made a splash on more than one Jazz Fest stage. Last week, Louisiana Eats interviewed local entrepreneur Orlando Vega, a Miami transplant and son of Cuban immigrants. Orlando's childhood memories of his grandmother's meals inspired him to launch Congreso Cubano, a thriving catering operation that serves up traditional Cuban food.
More than anything, it was New Orleans that inspired me to bring Cuban food back up here. I grew up in Miami, thinking that Miami was by far the most Cuban city outside of Cuba, with the deepest Cuban roots and the longest Cuban history. And upon moving here, almost immediately, I discovered how wrong I was, that Miami, you know, as a city, barely exists into the 19th century. But by the mid-19th century from New Orleans, we had famous Cubans like Narciso Lopez trying to launch revolutions, you know, Cuban revolutions from here. And so the Cuban history here just really is 2-3 times as deep as it is in Miami. And that fact blew me away. And it seemed like something that someone had to bring to the table. If it wasn't me, it was just missing.
In 2017, Orlando's 3-year business got a major boost. That year, Jazz Fest featured Cuba in its cultural exchange pavilion, giving Orlando the opportunity to present his food and his first cooking demonstration on the fairgrounds. Ever since then, he's been a regular vendor. But his connection to the Jazz Fest goes beyond the realm of the culinary. I'll let Orlando explain what I mean, but first, I asked him to take us back to when his association with the festival began in 2017.
My relationship with Jazz Fest began when Michelle Nugent, I believe it was, and Tracy Jones secretly came and tried our food at Barrel Proof one day, and they loved it. And the next thing we knew was a phone call and a meeting, and it just kept rolling forward, and they were very excited, and we were very excited for... I discovered New Orleans through Jazz Fest. I would drive out here once a year for about 10 years before I moved out here just for Jazz Fest. So to all of a sudden be invited to serve my Cuban food for visiting Cuban artists and represent that culture at a Jazz Fest, it really was just a dream come true, a full circle.
And tell me about that experience. What was the Cuban exchange for you like? Because it sounds to me like you were having a very special experience that maybe your average festival goer didn't get by interfacing with the Cuban visitors.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, I met everybody because I was out there at 6 a.m. So, you know, Tomas Montoya, who helped organize the whole Cuba Pavilion, was a very sweet gentleman, but took me under his wing, introduced me to everyone there. His family's still in Santiago, so he had a big part in personally inviting these people over. And then I had the wonderful luck, I was very lucky that Cubans cannot handle spice. It is not part of our culinary tradition. We don't like spicy food very much. So all of these Cuban musicians that came to play and these Cuban artists that came to visit and see the United States for the very first time had a very hard time eating anything but my food at the New Orleans Jazz Festival because everything else was so spicy. So it ended up being an all-day affair and food exchange with these people, and it was just wonderful.
You know, Jazz Fest, it's a big, big job. Did you have to scale up in any way? How did you prepare to work in a situation with those kinds of quantities?
It was definitely our first operation of that size.
Yeah, how lucky you are to have your first operation of that size be just your little Jazz Fest debut.
Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun. And I think, you know, the answer to your question is months and months of menu planning. I think we would get a month and a half into a very fun ingredients idea before we realized we're going to need 10 fryers out there if we do this. And it was just very, very careful selection of menus and ingredients and logistics. And we had a blast doing it, though, and we can't wait to do it again. But I think that's what it comes down to is you got to have your game plan.
Oh, yeah. This is not for the amateur.
It was not. And they had us out there, and we weren't even on food row on pavement. They had us camping out there.
Yeah, wait, you're camping when you're at the pavilion, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But then you must have done a very, very good job. Were you surprised when you got the call to come back? Because that was supposed to be a one-time wonder. A country only comes as the visiting country once. And so that might have been your debut and your swan song as well, but it didn't work out that way.
That's correct. We were very surprised and very thrilled, and it was definitely a curveball, especially because, you know, the Jazz Fest staff works so hard to pull off Jazz Fest that when Jazz Fest is over, you can't reach any of them for a month. You know, forget about follow-up. They deserve a huge vacation. So when they reached back out to us a few months later, it was really out of the blue, and we jumped right on it. We were thrilled. And this Jazz Fest, I had the opportunity of performing with my group as well, overlooking my tent.
Now that is really something.
Yeah,
tell me about that.
We are Kumasi. It's a big 14-person Afrobeat orchestra.
What instrument do you play?
I play rhythm guitar.
I don't think I've ever seen you.
Yeah.
Summers
are off season because the band is scattered across the globe studying music. Half of them are in Africa, the other half in Cuba now. And we have a residency during season at the Blue Nile, at the Blue Nile Balcony Room, about twice a month. Some seasons Maison. And we do all the big Bayou Boogaloo, French Quarter Fest.
What came first, your band or your food business?
The band, barely.
Oh, okay.
A couple months.
You didn't perform in 2017.
No, not at all.
So how in the world, I mean, this is really something that you get the call that you're going to have a food booth in Food Area 1. That's kind of a prime mm-hmm. spot. Oh, and then somebody else calls you from a whole nother department and says, oh, you're performing on stage 2. Now, Orlando, how did this happen and how did you cope with it?
Well, you know, luckily I am the CEO of my company, but I am not the CEO of my band. So I didn't have to cope with organizing that side of it. My bandmate gave me the call and told me where to be. But let me tell you, it was the most – I've been playing music since I was 16, and I still get the butterflies every time I go on stage. It's a feeling I can't shake. Just before you hit that first note, I'm always a little jittery. And when we performed at Jazz Fest, it was maybe the first time in my entire life I was not nervous at all because I was so exhausted. I had to throw off my apron, run on stage, hit the last song, put my apron back on, and run to the Friars. I did not take that day off. But it was magical. You know, we played right over Food One, so I was looking over my family. And it was just a magical experience. And the dreams keep piling on. I got to find something to add on for next year at Jazz Fest. I don't know. I'm running out of ideas.
It's hard to top all that. it truly is. That's incredible. What has the reception been from the non-Cuban patron at Jazz Festival?
Oh, absolutely wonderful. I think, you know, New Orleans is a creature of habit and tradition. And I think there are a lot of people here doing amazing food that pays great homage to our Creole and Cajun tradition. But there's still a lot of room for more. And people are very hungry for it. And in many ways, as I've expressed, I think this is an integral part of our Creole and Cajun tradition, this food as well. So the reception is wonderful. People love our food. And some people are a little curious about it. Some people are a little intimidated by it, but we are a loud, friendly staff of Latinos ready to answer your questions. So please just step up and don't be shy.
That was Orlando Vega. To learn more about his catering business, visit congresocubano.com or visit their booth at Jazz Fest this year. If you want to learn more about Orlando's band, Kumasi, visit kumasiafrobeat.com. Let's have them take us out. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you visited poppytooker.com lately? That's where you'll find not only our full broadcasts, but our quick bites for podcasting or webcasting and special videos from producers Jonathan Evans and Marion Gay. That's all on poppytooker.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from Camellia Brand Beans. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Palace Cafe, home of the Weekend Jazz Brunch, featuring a build-your-own Bloody Mary bar located in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and special projects manager Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Molyneux. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.